Hi, I'm Sasha Coca, host of the California Report magazine. Every week, we bring you stories about what connects us in the giant, diverse Golden State. Because what happens in California changes the world.
I love this place. We were once seen as like the place to be, California. The land of milk and honey. That's where you go to Sunshine State. But we just have challenges right now.
KQED's California Report magazine. New episodes drop every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor of The New Yorker and host of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast. On the podcast, I ask a great contemporary writer to select a favorite story from the magazine's almost 100-year archive to read and discuss. Together, we delve into the story, exploring its themes, its style, and what makes fiction work. You can listen to authors like Otessa Moshfegh talk about why we write.
Story, or attaching a story or creating a story, is this inclination that we all have to stop spinning.
And you can hear writers like George Saunders discuss the nature of storytelling.
On the first read, you accept these things as descriptions and they make you see the scene, but every line is a chance to inflect the reader's mind.
You'll discover new favorite authors and read old favorites in new ways. Episodes of the New Yorker Fiction Podcast are released on the first of every month. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Tomo Nakayama is a singer and songwriter, most often found singing on stage to fans. But during the pandemic, the ability to play live shows and our ability to gather evaporated. Quarantined apart from his family, Tomo found himself filling his time like a lot of us did, by watching Netflix. He found comfort in watching episodes of Shinya Shokudo, or Midnight Diner, a TV series focused on a late-night diner in Tokyo that tells the stories of its customers and their colorful lives through focusing on the signature dish that they always order. These aren't sushi dishes. They're Japanese comfort foods like chicken cheese katsu, yakisoba sandwiches, omurice, and tonjiru, a savory pork and miso soup. In fact, it's this miso-based dish that the master makes in the opening sequence of the show. At the end of each episode, the main character narrates how to make their favorite dish, while the master breaks down each step in a quick cooking demonstration.
And it got to the point where I had watched the whole series like 4 or 5 times. And it was so like comforting. Like I knew the stories and what was going to happen. And so then a lot of those dishes I wanted to like recreate at home, you know. And I think that was kind of like the impetus for my curiosity in cooking.
When the pandemic took away the concert stage, it pointed Tomo towards the kitchen, inspiring curiosity and discovery, and a new way of expressing himself. This is The Blue Suit, a podcast about the commonplace things that touch our lives and the uncommon people that transform them into something remarkable. I'm Shinyi Pai. Today, miso. What does it mean to live a good life? On the acclaimed podcast No Small Endeavor, produced by Great Feeling Studios and PRX, theology professor Lee C. Camp explores this question every week, sitting down with courageous and impassioned people from all walks of life, like Hollywood legend Rob Reiner and New York Times bestselling author Gretchen Rubin. Like our show, the podcast covers intimate stories from the past and future, from conversations on cultural Korean beauty standards with TED Talk's daily host, Elise Hu, to discussions on how our religious differences should be treasured with Interfaith America founder, Eboo Patel. Together, they'll figure out what it means to find true happiness and how we can all flourish in our day-to-day life. Don't miss out. Follow No Small Endeavor on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Find Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts. Culturally specific foods have the ability to pull long-lost memories to the surface of the mind. Consider the aroma of the fresh-baked madeleine that once inspired a French novelist to write hundreds of pages about a search for lost time. Then there are the flavors that speak to the essence of a culture and its cuisine. Take miso paste. As a seasoning, it's been fermented. It doesn't need to be combined with a dozen other ingredients or flavors. Its basic nature is complex enough on its own, so much so that it's foundational to the Japanese diet.
It reminds me of home, you know? Just like every Japanese household, I think, wakes up to the smell of miso soup in the morning.
Miso is a basic ingredient in Japanese cooking, made of soybeans that have been ground and fermented. It comes in red, brown, and white varieties, which all vary in complexity, age, and taste.
People who are really into it, they can tell what part of the country it's from by the flavor, or they'll identify really strongly with it. That's their like childhood flavor. And so everybody claims that theirs is the best.
This specificity of taste is something Tomo remembers from a trip to visit his family in Kochi, the region in southern Japan where he was born.
My cousin's wife said that when she first married into the family's rice didn't taste right to her because she came from the mountains, and the family that she married into, they lived by the ocean. So like just from being so close to the salt water, there's just like a slight amount of salt in the flavor of the rice, which like I wouldn't be able to tell, you know, but like she said, yeah, it took me years to get used to that flavor.
So subtle.
Yeah, it's so subtle. And in Japan, they call it kodawari. It's just, it shows care for each ingredient and like where it comes from and how it was grown.
Tomo's go-to brand of miso is from Tosa in Kochi.
Well, okay, so I'm opening.
Tomo brought a plastic tub of miso to our conversation to show me. A square container with blue and black Japanese kanji characters printed on the packaging.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got this slightly funky fermented, you know, scent to it.
Inside was a thick brown paste with the consistency of smooth peanut butter.
But there's so many layers of, well, in Japan it's called umami, right? What is umami?
I don't know the translation of that one.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's that flavor, and like umami is that like kind of depth of flavor that we don't really have a word for, I guess, in English.
What is something that is umami? Like if you were eating it and you were describing that flavor or that character to someone, you know, what has an umami kind of profile?
Like mushrooms, cheese. Cheese has a lot of umami, you know, it's that kind of like
complexity,
depth, the thing that like lingers on your taste buds.
Have you ever like made your own miso? I've heard that like really aged old miso can be quite delicious. Like once Etsuko Ichikawa brought me some food when I was like recovering from a surgery, and she told me like this is from a 10-year-old miso. And wow. You know, it's like it almost made me wonder like, is there like a vintage to these things, like, you know, vinegar or soy sauce or wine?
Yeah, that's probably true. I have no idea, you know? So, like, I'm Japanese, but I grew up here most of my life. So, I'm, like, what they call a 1.5 generation immigrant. I have the memory of my homeland, but like for all intents and purposes, I'm an American person, you know? So I feel like I'm just in this kind of like limbo zone sometimes where I don't feel quite at home, like either here or in Japan. I don't know where my home is really, but like I got homesick for Japan.
Homesickness is one way to talk about it, but it's almost more like a longing for what's absent, which is pretty much an ongoing condition for people of the diaspora. A nostalgia or feeling for something that may have never even existed beyond the imagination.
A lot of the knowledge I have of Japan and the culture is just from a foreigner's perspective,
right.
I think.
From a distance.
Yeah, a little bit of a distance. So it's been sort of this like backward search for my identity.
Food can be a complicated and shame-fraught experience for the kids of immigrants. What we eat pegs us instantly as one of the crowd or someone who doesn't belong. The school lunchroom is where that drama plays out.
I remember when I was a kid, my mom would package up these really traditional meals for me, like in like a recycled aluminum tin with like a soy sauce egg and like stewed chicken and daikon. It was almost like an Odin stew. And, you know, the other kids were coming with their peanut butter sandwiches and their like disposable brown bags. And, you know, they'd turn up their noses at what I would bring. And that was like my bento box moment as a kid of like, you know, food shaming.
Yeah. Did you see that show Fresh Off the Boat?
Yeah.
There's that first episode where the kid goes to the grocery store and sees the aisle of, what is it called? Lunchables. And it's all glowing. And that resonated with me so much because I remember feeling just that lure of like the boxed lunch. And it was so exotic to me. And like, yeah, my mom was making me rice balls and stuff like that. And kids would kind of go, ew, you know. Yeah, that's a very universal thing, I think, among Asian kids growing up. But it is funny now how much I just really wanted to eat Lunchables. it's not very good, is it? But, yeah.
The unprocessed foods that we grew up with may seem like a deep source of embarrassment, but in reality, an ingredient like miso can be incredibly versatile. It can be used in salad dressings, desserts, marinades, braises, and stews. Miso can be eaten, cooked, or raw. It's even made its way into fusion cuisine and non-Asian cooking. And in this way, there's a place for what was once embarrassing to become a source of pleasure, even pride. It's not unusual to stray from the foods that our bodies were most familiar with as young people, because our palates become acculturated to other tastes. But an ingredient like miso, which offers both comfort and complexity, has that power to take us back to another self through its pungence and redolence. It's worth savoring on its own, though that appreciation might come later in life. The shock of the pandemic led Tomo to seek out what was comforting, like familiar Japanese television shows and simpler flavors. During the pandemic, I also watched a lot of Midnight Diner like Tomo. But instead of recreating recipes like chicken fried rice or Japanese pork loin from the show, I was drawn to returning to the flavors of my own childhood, prepared with the tools that I had at hand. I spent a month perfecting a bowl of rice porridge, made not on a gas stove, but in a slow cooker. I recreated a version of my mom's pickled garlic cucumbers using Korean gochugaru pepper flakes and tamari. I ate my homemade pickles at breakfast and dinner, just like my mom would, and thought about my mom a lot while I ate them. I also started making miso soup for breakfast. The early days of pandemic, with its long stretches of unstructured, unfilled time, gave Tomo an opportunity to explore his curiosity, and cooking was one of the only things he felt like he had the energy to do.
I was just so exhausted all the time. I'd just wake up and I just have no desire to play music even. And so I think I put all my creative energy into cooking.
Pre-pandemic, Tomo didn't have a strong connection to cooking. His relationship to cooking unfolded over time. When he was a kid, his mother took care of the food prep. He'd help out when she asked.
Washing the rice, that was my job.
Yeah, it's an easy thing.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's also hard because you have to like keep your hand in this cold water for 5 minutes or something.
And keep rinsing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she did that mom thing where you're like, she's like, oh, the rice tastes so much better when you rinse it. You know, like you do it so well. And I was like, yeah, totally. But that was just her Jedi mind tricking me into like doing chores.
Cooking takes confidence. In his 20s, Tomo found himself buying bags of frozen vegetables from Trader Joe's because it felt somehow less intimidating. Relating to ingredients in their unprocessed natural form takes some getting used to. And the pandemic made plenty of space for that kind of relating.
I remember like the first couple weeks of lockdown, the International District was kind of a ghost town. Nobody wanted to go. And people were like throwing rocks through the windows and stuff. And there was a lot of kind of fear of being Asian, you know. But I wanted to support those businesses.
Tomo picked up ingredients from Uwaji Maya and local businesses in the Chinatown International District. He made Japanese recipes that felt comforting, like omu rice and tamago yaki. As he got more adventurous, he branched out, cooking recipes from a Japanese recipe website, and he started to make things he'd never attempted before.
I talked to the fishmonger, and I asked him about mackerel. It's intimidating because it's a whole fish, and I don't know how to cut it. But he said that he would fillet it and clean it and gut it and everything for me. And so I went home, and I made this miso stewed mackerel, which is like a flavor that I really love, but it's a very like fishy fish.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, has a strong scent. I wasn't able to like cook it for other people. But now that I had my own space, I didn't mind making it really stinky, you know? So I tried this recipe and it's so simple, but it has so much depth of flavor.
Tomo photographed his home-cooked meals, sharing them with his other homebound friends, a distance potluck. It was a way to connect and check in on one another.
And then I kept noticing that, like, the recipes over and over would just call for those elements, you know?
Miso, sake, mirin, and dashi are the foundational ingredients of everything in Japanese cooking.
That's kind of the secret I found. It's not that complicated, you know? It's just like these like three or four ingredients that kind of unify everything.
Tomo's efforts paid off. He was able to recreate recipes from his favorite eateries that he could no longer visit, like miso black cod from Maneki, Seattle's oldest sushi restaurant, which is legendary for its obasans, grannies that host and tend bar.
You know, it's a very slow, long process where you just gotta like marinate the fish for 3 days in sake and miso and soy sugar. The cooking itself isn't that hard, but it's just the waiting, you know, in anticipation. That felt very, very magical to be able to create that experience in my own kitchen.
Cooking takes perseverance and practice to arrive at a level of sophistication and understanding of how to fuse together different ingredients. In this way, it's not at all unlike music.
Is there a relationship between cooking and creativity, you know, cooking and songwriting?
When I first started cooking, it was just following the recipes and doing it step by step, exactly the way it was written. But then once you kind of gain those skills and understand like the basics of how a song or like how a dish is made, it just becomes a part of you, and then you're able to just sort of spread out and kind of add your own flavor to things, you know?
Knowing that the character of miso is umami allows you to build depth into a dish and to ultimately improvise with it.
The harmony of those ingredients, like one can't really work without the other, you know? Or when those come together, it's like bigger than the sum of its parts.
When we allow ourselves to look more closely at what's familiar, we have a chance to clarify an understanding. The Oden stew I was ostracized for by schoolmates is a dish that I now share and enjoy with my husband and son, for its salty and bitter flavors. There are other tastes besides sweetness. Recognizing all the qualities that make up our own sensibilities is a part of coming home.
I think before the pandemic, I was getting really caught up in just working all the time and trying to make as much money as I can and constantly playing shows and just sort of in this like hamster wheel or something, you know? And the kinds of shows I'm playing and the people I'm playing for and the kinds of songs I'm creating, I want them to like resonate with my own values. You know, when I was in my 20s and kind of starting out in music, it was dominated by indie rock scene, which tends to be very insular and very very white, really. So I was trying to fit into that mold and trying to find my place in it, you know. I'm envious of younger artists coming up today because they're so in touch with their roots, with their heritage and their identity, and they make that a central part of their art, you know, which I think is really beautiful. And so that's been inspiring for me to watch as someone who like spent a lot of my youth just trying to fit in and assimilate, and I don't think I have to do that anymore, you know, which is a really, really great feeling. I mean, I'm on the radio talking about mackerel. That's how weird is that? You know, that never would have happened when I was a kid. So, yeah.
Check out our show notes to find out more about Tomo and his music. Next week's object is vitrified glass. Do you have a special object that you hold close? Share it with us on Instagram, tag at KUOW, and use the hashtag BlueSuitPod. The Blue Suit is produced by KUOW in Seattle. Our host, writer, and creator is me, Shin Yi Pai. Whitney Henry Lester produced this episode. Jim Gates is our editor. Tomo Nakayama wrote our theme music. Our production team includes Michaela Giannotti, Tio Popescu, Hans Twite, Melissa Takai, and Brendan Sweeney. Special thanks to the Windrose Fund for their financial support. If you like this podcast, KUOW has a lot more great audio for you. Search KUOW in your podcast app and see what piques your interest. Thanks for listening.
At Soundside, we bring you news and conversation rooted in the Pacific Northwest. Hi, I'm Libby Denkman. I think of my job hosting Soundside as, number one, asking tough questions of powerful people, the questions you, KUOW listeners, want answered. And two, bringing you a daily slice of the fascinating, confounding, and often goofy side of life in Washington State. Join me for Soundside at noon and 8 p.m. on KUOW or anytime on the Soundside podcast.